Thank you for this morning. Thank you for this beautiful sunny morning that we can come here and think about you and how we educate, how we approach our children's souls. Please remind us that these are souls that will never die, that these, just like we, are your property. We belong to you, and you made us to glorify you. So remind us of that in all we do, that great are the works of the Lord, as the psalmist says, and studied by all who delight in them. Make that our maxim today. Write it on our hearts and make us apply it consistently and not hide our hearts from the finger of your Spirit from writing that law and making us search out every area of our lives to see if there is any area, and especially this area of education, is so important to you in making disciples, and pointing our souls back to you. So, Lord, let us take this seriously. Let it be worship to you. Let all that we say today be honoring to you. We pray that you would guard my lips from error and guard our hearts from distraction. We pray all of this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. So the title of mine, before we're going to watch a video in a second here to open off, but the title is going to be Objective Trivia. Not trivia, trivium. Aha, got you. The opposite of trivia. And that actually might be two words that are potentially unfamiliar to you, particularly that Latin one, trivium. And I'll explain what I mean by that. But what I want to do to open off is I want to set the backdrop against something that you're going to be tempted throughout this talk, because this talk is so heady. And I want to invite you to stretch your mind with me to look into these things. But I'm going to show you something that's going on in culture right now. You may have seen this commercial. This is not an op-ed piece. This is not a reporter from MSNBC doing her own thing. This is representative of that network and representative of a lot of the people that I grew up with talk openly like this. But maybe this will clarify why we do what we do, why we're doing the academy, why we can't simply hide in how we do the education of our children, but why we actually have to play to win. What I'm going to show you is a commercial put out by MSNBC by a reporter named Melissa Harris. And I think it speaks for itself. But just in case it doesn't, afterwards, I'm going to speak more to it. So, without further ado, this is MSNBC's Melissa Harris.
We have never invested as much in public education as we should have, because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families, and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's everybody's responsibility and not just the households, then we start making better investments.
Well, if you think that is a minority position, an obscure idea of a handful of people, you'd be wrong. And that is a tragic way to think in a lot of ways. And while our hearts can be sympathetic toward such people, that's not really our concern when the question becomes, what are you going to do for your own children? What do you have to do before God? So if you can undistract your mind from the us versus them aspect to this for just about 3 hours and think instead about, okay, what is the opposite of that? And there's a lot of opposites of that that Christians have proposed. I want to read just a handful of words from 2 Timothy 1:14. Josh is actually going to read from 2 Timothy 1 as well when he gets to his talk, but does the Bible have anything to say about classical education, form of education, right words, right ideas in education? You might be surprised. These are just a couple of words, and we'll read others from Paul's thoughts to Timothy later. But he says to Timothy to follow the pattern of sound words. Every word there is interesting. I'll get into them a little bit, but pattern or abstract or standard, the NASB says, is hupotupos, which might not excite you very much. But that word tupos is where we get the word type. in the English. It's a die cut. It's a standard. It's a stamp. It's a single thing with words, plural. It's a unified thing with many signals on it. And sound, interestingly, is the word hygienos, where we get the word hygiene, health, health of the body. And then there's that word words. Follow the single object of sound, plural words, is what Timothy's being commanded. There's been a renaissance in classical education in the past couple of years. Obviously, if you're here, most of you at least, are aware of that. It's run parallel to the rise of the homeschooling movement, and it's a good thing. But I am sorry to say that the specific application of classical learning in this movement very often, just as the more general rationale for homeschooling very often, has been largely driven by reaction, superstition, and then right back full circle toward secular officialism, which I'm going to talk about a little bit throughout, especially in our application time. The parents have rightly revolted against the government schools as increasing numbers of parents realize the shortcomings of those schools in bits and pieces. But reaction is no substitute for a real system of thought. One craving for pragmatic security comes to replace another when we tend to think by instinct and fear. And the conscientious Christian parent, without an objective, whole philosophy of education, must choose between adopting forms and materials that still flow from John Dewey's polluted stream in public education on the one hand, or else reinventing every wheel on the other. On either extreme, the homeschooling parent or the startup school will have to genuflect to some official institution, hence the name officialism. Something official, something real, something tangible. In other words, something with lots of bells and whistles, structure to restore the order of things. Now, please understand that when I say that, we want bells and whistles. We want administrative stuff. Except that when we say bells and whistles, when we ring bells and blow whistles, what we mean is something a little bit more like Paul Revere crying out that the British are coming. Except that the British, in this case, are well represented by that woman on the MSNBC commercial. Bells and whistles are for the sleeping and the dead. And so we want them to wake up the dead at first, to gain that first attention of our fellow colonists. But they can only take you so far into the woods away from that woman's friends. We're going to come full circle back to that current crisis in our culture at the end. But let's turn now to the thing that really makes us alive all the way and awakens us. And that is something called objective truth. And Paul's letter to Timothy makes it clear that the classical pagan in the ancient world had no corner on the market of educational theory. Paul opens with his concerns that really mirror the three stages of the trivium. If you look not only at that verse that I mentioned, but the one that Josh is going to talk about, and really the whole context of Paul's letters to Timothy, he is going to be everywhere mirroring the concerns that form the three stages of the trivium. If you're not familiar at all with classical education, in the classical world, in other words, for 2,500 years that built everything good that you call good, those guys, this is the way they educated children up until about 80 years ago when Dewey's philosophy won. What they did is they arranged education into the seven liberal arts. Now, the quadrivium we're not going to talk about, that was college, those four things. But you had to be ready for that, so you had to take the trivium. What's trivium? Well, it's Latin for way of three or road of three, tri via, way of three. And what that comes to mean is three stages of the child's development that correspond to three different stages of his soul. First of all, there's the grammar stage, and that's what we're going to call as Christians objective words. Secondly, there's the logic stage or the dialectic stage, and we're going to call that the objective type. Remember that word tupos that Paul mentioned to Timothy. One thing. And then thirdly, we're going to look at rhetoric, objective defense. Here's what it means in layman's terms. If you're not familiar with this, if you've never heard this before, this way of three that everybody learned everything by, to the point where, I don't know if you ever heard of that study, the eighth grade exam from the 1880s that was given to the faculty at Yale and nobody could pass? Yeah. The people that we think were stupid and simple back then were actually light years smarter than the so-called smartest people from today and built Western civilization as we know it. Those guys. This is the way they educated their children. But a way is not enough if there's not stuff on the path. So at the heart of this classical model, this framework, this system that goes by the name trivium, are these stages of grammar and then logic and then rhetoric. This is the way that Western man has been schooled for 2.5 millennia, hence the civilization which was cultivated and preserved by it. The first advantage of this way of learning is psychological. So, in other words, everywhere they went, they were going somewhere their soul was already going. They were going with the grain of the soul. They weren't fighting against it, as today's educational methodology does. So to say it's psychological is to say that the method conforms to the objective way that God made the soul to begin with. We want to have an educational theory that actually fits the way the soul runs, whether we like it or not. Grammar corresponds to the child's propensity from age 5 to 9, roughly, to trust the adults of the world and to take in their world of information as a sponge would absorb water. You may have noticed if you have kids. It's a good thing. You say, wait, that's imperialism. What's going to happen if they trust us? Well, not all grammars are equal. But they're going to trust adults and ask questions in order to get answers, whether we give them the right ones or not. Secondly, logic corresponds to the child's propensity from about age 10 to age 14 to reach for independence, to inquire, to synthesize what he or she already knows about the world. And then finally, rhetoric corresponds to the now young adult's propensity from about age 15 to 18 to articulate, to challenge, and to take one's stand in the world. Here's the big idea. If you get nothing else from anything we talk about today, here's the big idea. I keep coming back to this. All truth is a singular object. That's that word tupos that Paul used to Timothy. The pattern, the standard, the stamp, the singular object with many sound words in it. It's one thing. There's one way to think about everything. Or it ain't Christian. And it ain't rational. Like that, ain't rational. I can be funny about this. It's going to be fixed, so we got to do some of that stuff. All truth is a singular object to be patterned in everything we do. So let's look at the first point first. Objective words, or the grammar stage. What is grammar? That's probably going to be the one that most interests you, because as I look out there, I see a lot of your children are in that younger stage, maybe not even up to it yet. So grammar is primarily a framework of reality. That's the first difference between us and the garden variety classical method. We're actually claiming that we know the way that God made the soul. And we know the way God made the world. We don't just have a method. We see them, they're a sponge with two legs, and there are our kids and they're asking us a lot of questions. We better tell them something. No, more than that, we actually believe that what we believe is true. Grammar is, first of all, a framework for reality. It is only secondarily a stage or a method. Watch that in classical education. Is it primarily a stage, framework, method, or is it stuff? If it's not stuff, content, it's not Christian. We're not likely to get the most out of the stage or the method if we don't first see grammar as a true object containing other true objects. All words mean things. This is without exception. And we can see this in the Latin words for things like word and name and thing. Just a little Latin slash grammar slash logic slash English 101. In other words, just a little common sense 101 time. Look at these words. Verbum, word. Nomen, name. That's where we get the nominative case when we're learning languages. It's the thing you're talking about. And that drives us to the thing or res, from which we get the English words real and reality. Now, from these words, we derive the principal parts of speech. Noun, nomen. In other words, I'm naming the thing. And verb, verbum. I'm telling you about the thing. And then that which they represent, namely things, res, which further came to derive those words real and reality. This is the first imperative of Paul to his main son in the faith, Timothy. Words, words, words. They are not mere words. They're the stuff of reality. There's a battle going on for definition. The doctrine that words represented real objects of the mind, objective truths, which were eternally true, universally true, in the Middle Ages was called realism. It's a Christian doctrine. It's a biblical doctrine. Paul said to the Romans in Romans 1:20 that the invisible things of him are clearly seen, even his eternal power and divine nature, through the things that have been made, so clear that they're without excuse. That should form your philosophy of education. When you look at anything, you're looking at one of two things. You're looking at something in the mind of God, or in addition to that, you're looking at an attribute of God. These are the examples. These are the passing paint colors. If you don't think that way, you're not thinking biblically yet. Words, the stuff of reality. That doctrine was called realism. But as the Middle Ages came to the close and the new universities were pressured to compete with things like the printing press and independent humanistic art forms that weren't under the control of the church anymore, a rival doctrine called nominalism challenged this singular universal type that Paul commanded Timothy. Type of truth. Remembering those two Latin words for a second, nomen was the name that we give, and res was the thing itself. Realism, here's the difference, realism insisted that universal truths, things like justice, or there are 20 people in this room right now, period, those things, universal truths, which are ultimately all true propositions, are eternal objects, first. Scientific objects, second. Either attributes of God or knowledge in the mind of God. But either way, they are all unchanging, immaterial objects of the mind, first. Nominalism challenged this between the 11th century and 14th century and finally won the PR war. And they said, no, universals, predicates, attributes of things, these are just names that we give. They're useful, but they're not real things. The realists in the Middle Ages, like Anselm of Canterbury, Thomas Aquinas, and John Wycliffe, all understood that if nominalism won, then the Christian idea of the university would disintegrate. And with it, civilization that was built by that university. By the way, university is not the building downtown. That's a plural versity. That's not a university. A university is a Christian word. It's a Christian idea. Unity to the diverse things. In other words, that tupos that Paul commanded Timothy. One thing, one worldview, one truth, many particular things that make it up. Nominalism won the PR war, and they understood, these guys did, that if nominalism won and words just meant whatever, then anarchy would be unleashed and civilization would be lost and a new dark ages would emerge. Well, realism did lose, and eventually so too was the West lost. And here we are, over a couple hundred years later, a couple million dead bodies later in this last century alone. And if you're asking, wait a minute, really? You're gonna link that to Nazism? Absolutely. Straight line, the main cause of every dead body in the 20th century, over 100 million. These guys understood that. Truth alone builds and preserves civilization. Truth's contrary tears it down. And just as it takes the right stuff to build the walls of a physical fortress, so it takes the right stuff, or the way Paul always used these phrases, sound stuff, to build the more foundational walls of a metaphysical fortress. That's the more real fortress that undergirds medieval castles and American defense systems. And the basic building blocks of this stuff are what we mean by objective grammar. Grammar, after all, is content. To be more specific, grammar is the sum of words that represent reality. Grammar is inherently objective. The words derive their meaning from the thing itself, not from what you feel it is, not from what you think it is, not from a consensus, a vote, a majority vote. The word derives its meaning from the thing. To the degree that the meaning of words become divorced from real objects, or objects as they really are, that's what we mean by objective. If you don't have an objective view of truth, you don't think like a Christian, you think like an atheist. To the degree that these things don't really mean the thing itself, our grammar will be less like grammar. It might go by that name, but it will be a nominal grammar. Grammar only a name and not a real grammar. It'll be a nominalistic grammar and not a realist grammar. Well, there are anti-grammars. I've got a list of them here. A child-centered methodology for education. That's not a big philosophy. That's just a philosophy of education. No, your philosophy of education rests on your philosophy of words and things. It doesn't matter what you put at the center. If what you put at the center is not the ultimate thing, then no thing will mean the same thing. You have to get your whole theology right to get anything right in a way that will last. There's anti-grammars. How do I define an anti-grammar? Well, an anti-grammar can be either an explicitly anti-classical view, or it can be an amateur attempt at recovering the classical form. It can be either one. An amateur attempt to recover the classical form, but one which is still essentially nominalistic or pluralistic in its philosophical orientation. I don't think I'm going to have to convince too many people here of the failure of the modern secular education theory that goes out there in the public schools. Whether it's child-centered, which was set forth by Rousseau in the 18th century, or whether it's experiment-centered, championed by John Dewey in the 20th century, these are attempts to begin treating human beings fundamentally different than human beings have been developed for over 2,000 years in the West. And the results were predictable to thinking Christians. They knew it would lead to the loss of meaning and then the loss of life. But even though there's anti-grammars on purpose, there's also anti-grammars on accident. You don't have to defiantly oppose the classical way and tell everyone why you're doing it. You can just be unaware that your philosophy of education rests on a right philosophy of things. There's Christian models, classical models, that are still essentially subjective, relativistic, in the grammar that they impress on the child's mind in the grammar stage. Because the overall system of truth is not a system at all, but a pluralistic hodgepodge of trivia, which is a perversion of the trivium. There's just another word that has lost its meaning. Trivia, from trivium. Trivium was supposed to be attached to the meaning of the most important things. Now it's trivia pursuit, and it's a board game. Well, what makes the difference? Well, an anti-grammar is just any grammar, accidental or on purpose, any grammar that is not objective all the way down to the core and all the way out to everything else. If you want a standard to that, ask yourself this. How does the center of an educational theory answer the question, what is most real? The answer to that question is their all-pervasive object. You might say to that, well, I'm the parent and I go to church and I don't have to have that subject say what is most real. Yes, you do. It'll collapse in on itself, and it won't last for more than 2 or 3 years at best. What is most real? The answer to that question is the all-pervasive object in your system, even without consciously placing an object at the center. You say, I don't have an object at the center. You're a human being, and the human mind needs a center. Consider these four other options that we've seen. Let's look at this chart right here. We've seen these in the modern world. Now, the first two are obviously secular, and the fourth one is trying to not be secular, but in fact it's just the pagan view. And then the third is trying to be more than pagan. But do any of them succeed at having the right thing at the center? Well, if anybody needs a refresher course on these anti-grammars, if you want details in it, you can find Josh's talk that he gave last year. It's on the website. It's called A Case for a Classical Christian Education. So what we want to do this year is we want to take a step further in that same direction and ask the question, what's the connection? What's the connection between God as an object of study at the center of every subject? What's the connection between that, right theology at the center? Because I still fear we're sort of pasting that on. Yeah, he's my center. My private Jesus. Well, I don't mean that. Yeah, you do. That's the words you just used. We're just pasting it on in the center. What's the connection between that right doctrine of God on the one hand and the objectivity of words out here? Grammar, logic, rhetoric on the other. Well, let's start with grammar. What are the principal characteristics of objective grammar and what are the principal characteristics of its opposite? Well, in the first place, objective grammar is an anthology of objects. All of its terms are true about the world. That's the first test you have to pass. Does the word accurately correspond to the nature of the thing that it's talking about? So consequently, the first test that has to be passed, and it's really the simplest to judge of all the rest that we're going to talk about, is whether or not each individual word is really predicated concisely and accurately by its definition. Let me give you one example, and we'll turn to English grammar to make this example. In Webster's or any other dictionary prior to Thorndike early in the 20th century, every word was defined etymologically. In other words, the Greek or the Latin or in some cases the French root was listed first and derivatives followed, with contemporary common use coming last. So, etymological root first, derivation second, common usage of that word last. Why? What makes the difference? It's because the purpose of the dictionary was to discover what thing a word named. Res preceded nomen. Thing, object, preceded the word. Or to say it another way, dictionaries were written theologically. Every word was understood by its primal object, and only then could their derivatives orbit. If you read Webster's dictionary, you'll see scriptures referenced. I'm talking about the original. You will see words that say, now this word was this thing in the Bible, and you're like, well, that's a neat snippet, but does that really belong in a dictionary? No, you don't understand what Webster understood. If you don't understand the word that way, you don't understand the thing at all. That thing is what God spoke it into existence as. Dictionaries were written theologically. Get used to this. If you're saying, what does math have to, do you have to get the doctrine of God right to get a dictionary right? Yes. Get used to it. You'll keep seeing it. Every word was understood by its primal object. And only then could the derivatives orbit around that. The study of English as a whole was framed into etymology, phonology, orthography, syntax, semantics, and prosody. Accordingly, so as to move from the thing to the concept to the signal. The signal came last. The signal was there to serve the object, not the other way around. You can't be neutral about that without missing the object in everything else you talk about. By the way, is everything else kind of dependent on English? It does if you're an English-speaking person and your teachers are English, doesn't it? But what if your English is all jacked up? What if it's all postmodern? Then everything else gets collapsed into that problem. It's just one example, one angle. Newer dictionaries and contemporary textbooks on English simply bypass the question of being in language, which defeats the whole purpose of language. That's why we had a president asking sarcastically what the meaning of is. He wasn't just kidding. He didn't know, and neither did the people that were listening to him. Being in language, that defeats the whole purpose of language to not center it around that. Unless, of course, there's a new purpose of language. And that new purpose of language is to serve the purposes of those who control the language. George Orwell called this newspeak in his fictional works that made commentaries on collectivist ideology, Nazism, socialism. Now, that was only in his fiction work. But Orwell understood in an essay that he wrote, The Politics of the English Language, that if you control the meaning of words, you control the whole debate, and you control the lives of millions. Secondly, let's look at objective type. Words mean things individually. Now, what else did Paul mean? Remember that imagery. Don't lose that imagery. Tupos. Timothy, follow the tupos of sound words. The single object, like a stamp, which stamp has lots of words. So in grammar, we get the right words. But that's not enough. It's a single object, which is why we use words like world, not world's view, world view. Single, one, no other options. Only one right way to think about everything. But none of us, you're changing the subject. There's only one right way to think about everything. But that's only in the mind of God. You're changing the subject. What's your goal in life? To not think God's thoughts after him? To point your children, well, none of us will ever measure up, so therefore think about something else? Objective type. This is the logic stage, the dialectic stage. Second test of objective grammar begins to move in a more complex direction. And this is going to take us to the logic stage, but we're not going to leave grammar behind. We're not going to leave behind that principle that words mean things. Ultimately, it's going to be the same law when you get to the logic stage. Words represent things, but they do this by intermediating between signs and things signified. So you have a sign, you have a word, and it's aiming at a thing. Now, how do you judge between those? So your kids, age 5 to age 9, it was enough to say, Mommy, what's that? Well, that's a thing. Well, what do you mean by a thing? Well, I mean like this. Here's an example of it. Good enough. Now they're going to ask, what does that thing have to do with that thing? Is there a word for that? And what you're doing is you're drawing a mental circle. That circle now, does it represent the real thing? That is also an object of the mind. So words are the fountains of facts, the channels of concepts, the illuminators of ideas. So I have in that picture that the idea is the thing balancing the word and the thing. Now, if it's a true idea, it will be of something that is real. And consequently, when words are combined with other words, this combination of words has to be objective. It must be accurate for the same reasons that individual words must be accurate. And this second step in objective grammar is met by multiple words or phrases, constructing a concept, often a more complex idea than the single word by itself. Consider the funny example in an old criticism that the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Would you like a non-Christian theologian to teach you how to draw those circles for your child? Would you like a pagan to parse that out for your child? That's okay, I'm not a pagan. All right, parse it out. Been doing it for hundreds. The Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Lots of words, plural. I know what those are. I know what some of those are. Is this phrase an object of grammar? I'm not asking now, does it contain objects of grammar? Of course it does. Words, singular. Is it, the phrase, an object of grammar? Well, certainly it is, but which object? Is the Holy Roman Empire the object as it was constructed back in that day? Is it the object as it's been deconstructed by its critics, or some object in between? And what is holiness? What makes a thing Roman? And what is an empire? There are actually, when you think about it, dozens and dozens and hundreds and thousands of objects, some simple, others complex, that compete for the rightful title to Holy Roman Empire. Which is most accurate? Can you begin to see that grammar actually begins to communicate a logic? And logic, in turn, still communicates a grammar. The pattern of words takes one side or another in a cosmic struggle for your child's soul. So there's words in themselves, and there are words in a universe of meaning. And what we start to see if we look into this is that no words ever exist in themselves without falling back into that bad philosophy we opened off with of nominalism, pluralism. Things are just so in name, and those things then have nothing to do with each other. Nothing will take a mind further away from the Christian worldview quicker, more comprehensively, than teaching that to your children at an early age. When we communicate words, any words, to our children outside of a singular universe of meaning, we are training their mind to think of words as mere things, and then those things as having independent existence from other things. Consider again Paul's word to Timothy for this pattern or standard, this tupos. That comes from that word for an impress or a die cut. It's a singular object containing particular information. It's a unity of what might seem at first to be diverse information. It's a pattern of sound words. Matthew Henry's commentary on that verse sees it as a catechism, an abstract. William Hendrickson and John MacArthur, in their commentaries, speak of it as an artist's sketch or a model, a blueprint from which an artist works on and patterns everything else after. J.I. Packer reminds us in his book on the catechism that that word catechism is actually a Bible word from Galatians 6:6, for example, where Paul says that one who is taught catechumenos, one who is taught a system, an abstract, a singular object. Now, that word abstract is just one more casualty of this loss of realism. One more casualty of war is that word abstract. What do you think of when you think of the word abstract? I remember I was in a job interview when I was 22 once, and it was a sporting goods store, and I told the guy that I was studying philosophy in college, and he said, oh, that's so interesting. It's these abstract ideas. I said, what are you doing with your hands? Obviously, I didn't want the job that much, but I started criticizing him. I said, what do you do? What did you hear me say? Did you hear pink unicorns? Did you hear me say pink unicorns? Did I stutter? Did I say pink unicorns? What did you hear when you heard the word abstract? Less real? It means the opposite. It means the exact opposite. Abstract used to mean an adjective first, a noun first. The quality of a universal, real, eternal object or an immutable, unchanging type. It has examples in the world. The things we see that are passing in and out of existence at every nanosecond, not even, that's an understatement, are the examples of it. They're the less real things. They're passing away. This is Christianity 101. We're not atheists. We believe the more real things are the things that are unseen. That's not a rah-rah speech when Paul talks like that. That's, oh, that's cute. I know I'm supposed to believe that in my heart, my private little Jesus world. No, that's real about physics. That's real about math. Well, nowadays, the word abstract means the exact opposite. As a noun, it used to mean the thing itself, the essence of things, anything. To abstract, verb form, meant to take your eyes off of this world and focus. It's mentally harder, and that's why we don't do it. That's why civilization comes from people doing that, and barbarism remains where people don't do that. So the victory, the triumph of naturalistic science over philosophy is what brings in Nazism. Talk to me afterwards, I'll draw the connections. But these guys in the Middle Ages understood that. What abstract means now is to start talking about fantasy stuff, things that are not practical, things that the expert class has not ruled on. Abstract. Spiritual. Noble. Cute. Off in your own little private corner. But actually it means the opposite. Leaving that aside, this is what logic is in the second stage. To abstract to the abstract. To combine, draw circles around things. To draw circles that are more real than the things you're drawing circles around. That's why I draw circles on the board. I'm colonizing. I'm imperializing your mind. I'm invading this world. I'm putting my feet and my brain where our prayers are to Jesus that says, let your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. I'm moving this way. That's the way your child's mind has to start working. Abstracting. Francis Schaeffer used to say all the time in his books that the trouble with too many evangelicals is that we tend to think in bits and pieces, not in abstract, not in wholes, not in worldview. We're not tough-minded about more stuff. We think in bits and pieces more like animals, by instinct. And so individual things are isolated from each other rather than put in worldview terms. But the truth of the matter is that this is human nature, to split apart things like that, to stay at that infantile state, to see things on the level of instinct, intellectually lunging at objects on their own, in isolation. But that's something that Western man resisted, only by great effort. Only one soul thinking at a time resisted that and rose above it and built civilization and staved off that animal instinct of barbarism. What separates the human from the animal is the same thing that separates a free man from a slave. And that is the ability to rise above the mere machine of nature with the intellectually focused mind fixed on immaterial, eternal, unchanging truths that stand above mere nature, tell mere nature what it is, stand above earthly rulers, and judge earthly rulers. Short of an objective logic, we are the silly putty of demons and tyrants. Now, those more abstract objects make up our third test for what makes an objective grammar. we want to ask the question, are our children memorizing abstract objects, more real objects? So what did you hear again? Are our children memorizing abstract objects? Which doesn't mean they don't memorize the date that somebody won a battle, and they don't memorize which particle is which in an atom. It doesn't mean that. It means that you know what the thing is you're talking about, and you memorize that in your grammar. Are general categories of the mind, universal truths, memorized in the form of definitions? Definitions that consider these truths to be objects. Definitions which teach our children these are more real objects than these things that are dust and chalk. If not, then your logic stage and the very gateway of it, the grammar stage, will lack the power to draw deductions, to draw circles around things, to synthesize more of the world quicker when you get to that next stage. In other words, this will stunt your mind. Think about barbarism for a second. How long were people just riding around on horses, picking bugs and berries out of the... How long were people doing that? Typically a long time, right? How long have people been driving cars, flying planes, stuff like that? Not so long. What's the connection? Your mind will be stunted if you don't think logically. Conversely, when we start to think logically, we don't zoom out by 10 years, 20 years. We zoom out by centuries. We catch up by centuries. We learn millennia worth of stuff in weeks and months that it would take people normally painstaking years and years to accumulate and build if they were just studying it inductively. This is learning on hyperjet. The logical mind is a lot like a mental avalanche. It's a good avalanche. This is going to be a good avalanche here. But the fewer categorical truths. So logic is dealing with propositions. You're not just single words. You're memorizing things that take huge chunks of the world, huge chunks of history, huge subjects, and, for example, takes physics, chemistry, geology, astronomy, and biology and draws a circle around them, and that circle is not something that can be studied by science. And what are you doing? You're doing something that took 600 years for people to figure out by drawing that circle. But you can only do that with categorical statements, and in logic, there's four different kinds of categorical statements. Won't be on the test. You don't have to memorize it here. I'm just going to use one example to show how this works. I actually had all bears are meat eaters in my notes. I don't know how it turned into mammals when I got there, but that's a good one for kids to learn. You know, we spend so much time watching these cartoons where animals are cute and talk to each other and have rights and stuff like that. Well, all bears are meat eaters. Well, if Yogi is a bear, then Yogi's a meat eater. Meat eater, I'm meat. Uh-oh. Well, that's just one example. See, people have problems like that when they grow up watching cartoons like that, but they can't think like that. I'm not saying burn those cartoons. I'm just saying think like that, you won't have that problem. But these are categorical truths, fixed objects of the mind. And the fewer we have in our mind, the weaker the force of our deductions and the fewer that we'll make when we get to that stage. The poverty in our categorical grammar, words and concepts as objects, communicating propositional truth, the poverty in that will put us behind in logic. We will have smaller, weaker circles to draw around fewer objects in the world, and our minds will begin a process of falling behind others. Regress. Others who can draw larger, stronger circles around increasingly more objects. And dictators are just people who on the one side of their mouth deny that worldview, but out of the other, do that very well and impose those circles on others. This is an arms race of logic. The speed and the expanse of these circles will grow exponentially for those who don't fall behind in it. So if all grammar is content, this is where we're going to bring in theology. Okay, how does this relate to the center, though? If all grammar is content, and doesn't it stand to reason that the most central things should be the most central content? Let's ask the question this way. Are there any things, so things that you study, are there any things that everything has in common? Whatever that is, better be your central object of study. If I find out that every science has to use words, then the meaning of words had better be more central in my grammar than this particular inductive research in science. If I find out that every science runs by a scientific method which no science can study, then I better make that scientific method and the principle of falsifiability more central in my study than this particular experiment. Are there objects of study that are literally in and, in fact, make up all of the other objects of study? If so, then the grammar of those universal things will be the most important to the objective nature of every other thing. If you remove those most central things, it would be like moving the sun in our solar system. Good luck to those planets. Good luck to light and heat and so on. But unfortunately, it is just these universals that have been removed from the trivium. And this can best be seen by simply delving into each subject as an object of grammar. So let me just give a couple of examples. Let's start with science. I gave this list to the people at BSU last week. 10 things you need to do science which are not scientific things. What do you do with that if you're a naturalist? Well, if you're a naturalist, you look dumb. You want a good example of this, YouTube this. William Lane Craig debating against somebody. William F. Buckley was the moderator. I don't know who the other guy is. Here's one reason I don't know who the other guy is. He'll be forgotten because he looked like an idiot. No, it wasn't Hitchens. It was some older dude. But, man, it was bad. It was bad. William Lane Craig says, I'll give you some things that science can't study, that science needs. He's like, oh, yeah, give me a list. And he gives him a list of five, starts railing off these things, and the guy's eyes are like, he wasn't expecting him to have an answer. This is not something that they think about. However, there is a reason why science develops in the Christian West and doesn't elsewhere. There's a reason for that. It wasn't luck. You say, well, yeah, but it was divine providence. Yes, but divine providence works through secondary causes. There's a reason for this. We might ask somebody who wants to study nature according to philosophical naturalism what science he will use to study science. As a matter of fact, there are several things that science requires that are not physical phenomena at all. Only theology and philosophy can account for such things. And you don't leave it behind as a little nice, pithy expression. Now it's time to do science. I got that. It's in my center. No, you're not leaving it. It's going to stay with you. Or you're not doing science. Logic, causality, quantity, repeatable order in the cosmos, the subject-object distinction, a common field of observation, the scientific method, creation being a good thing, an ultimate object of reference that's infinite and therefore is a sufficient motive to inquire infinitely, and an atmosphere of freedom to inquire without fear of manipulation. Those are things that only a Christian worldview gives. There is no science without that, which is why only Christians have ever done it. So no. There's been scientific technological advances in ancient Greece, Ming Dynasty, Middle Ages, and Islam. Take a closer look, and you'll see that in those eras, there was a turn toward monotheism. And when that monotheistic turn was persecuted and pushed back, science went away. Technology went away. Why is that? What about English? In English, only the right doctrine of God, just like only the right doctrine of God in science will create science, only the right doctrine of God will see, for example, prepositions as objects. Have you ever thought about that? See, if I'm an atheist and you say, hey, I'm hiding under the table, I know what to do with that. Table, you, space, time, particles, got it. But if I say equal under the law, or no one's above the law, well, you're right back to Bill Clinton saying, what is the meaning of is? Is. You don't know what to do with it. Are prepositions objects? While you're at it, do you teach prepositions as objects? No, an object is, that's atheism. An object is an eternal thing first. This is a phenomenological manifestation of that. I don't expect you to say that to your kids. But physicists are finally realizing, that was actually true. There's nothing there that's not caused by something immaterial and intelligent. All right, if that's the case, what about math? Surely math, my goodness, 2 plus 2 equals whatever that guy's going to write, right? Well, only the right doctrine of God will see quantity, whether it's discrete quantity, that's numbers, or continuous quantity, that's form. Only the right doctrine of God will see quantity as an eternal essence in the mind of God. And therefore, only the right doctrine of God will see mathematical truths as true. In her 2004 book, Total Truth, Nancy Piercy said this. She said, you might not think that there's a Christian view of mathematics, but there is. Certainly, everyone, believer or not, will agree that 5 plus 7 equals 12. But when you ask how to justify mathematical knowledge, people split into several competing camps. Today, however, most philosophers no longer even regard mathematics as a body of truths. The dominant philosophy of mathematics treats it as a social construction, like the game of baseball. Three strikes and you're out is an arbitrary rule. It's not true or false. It's just the way we choose to play the game. By the same token, mathematical rules are regarded as just the way we play the game. Even American school children are now taught this postmodern view of math. Say, no, they're not. It's not a philosophy. It's just the numbers. No, it's not. They're taught this postmodern view of math, Piercy says. He says, a popular middle school curriculum says students should learn that mathematics is man-made, that is, arbitrary. And good solutions are arrived at by consensus among those who are considered experts. Solutions to what? The philosophy snippet in the introduction? No, solutions to the math problems in the whole book. So you can object, what do I care about justifying mathematical knowledge? I only care that my child gets enough math to practically move in the world, to count, to figure, to balance the budget, to get the core requirement toward a college degree. Well, my reply is that you now have two strikes against you in your movement toward an atheistic worldview, and now your child does too. All mathematics, first of all, is mathematical truth justification. That's why it has that symbol equals in the middle of it, all the way through algebra and so on. It's an extension of A equals A. The leading atheist of the 20th century, Bertrand Russell, co-authored a book with Alfred North Whitehead called The Principia Mathematica, in which he took about 40 pages to prove that 2 plus 2 equals 2, 4. Well, yeah, he's an atheist. He might have done that. But the whole point of the thesis was that all mathematics, deductive and inductive aspects of it, are an extension of the three fundamental laws of logic. That's an atheist. And what does he do after that? Oh, that's not good for reasons that I can talk to you about afterwards. But that's your first mistake if you think math and the solving and the practical part of it is non-theological. All mathematics is mathematical truth justification. All math is an extension of A equals A and a proof of it. In the second place, the reduction of math to slave function produces slaves. It won't be your child using math if you want it that way, but some slave master using your slave child through math. And there's a difference. What about history? Well, in history, only the right doctrine of God will see each point of history as the fullness of time and the plan of God for the ages. All history is theological interpretation. If there were not somebody standing over it saying, this is what's ultimately moving these people to this ultimate end, they wouldn't be studied that way. They would be studied like particles, like a scientist would want to study history if he's a naturalist. But if the players are not moving by ultimate ends, there would be no history. That's why it's called his story. All history is theological narrative. Likewise, the simplest names, dates, places, and events, there's a war of definition going on. Terms that you can look up in Wikipedia, like Greco-Persian War. I ask my students, I say, why are they calling it Greco-Persian War when it was always called the Persian War? First of all, why was it called the Persian War? Because it was a Greco-centric perspective. They started it, and if we don't beat them, they're going to kill us all. And there's no Western civilization after that. Well, that was an old view that Western man used to believe. So do you know that in the term Greco-Persian War, there's a taking of a side? There's a relativization of truth. Words like Palestine, about a territory that God clearly promised to one group of people. Words like Red Scare, about the House Committee on Un-American Activities in the 1950s. These are not neutral grammar terms. There's philosophy stuffed into it right down your child's throat. Each term takes a side. Each turn of syllable communicates philosophy and insists that your child make an inference and take a side. And beyond that, two types of souls are at stake in the constant telling of history, or in the ignoring of history, if you like. That was a fact that I was reminded of this week. There's a certain point we're going into the Punic Wars, and I mentioned that there was activity going on between the First Punic War and the Second Punic War. And somebody, one of the students, finally asked me, so they were fighting more just beside that fighting? And it occurred to me, something that seems obvious, but you need a refresher. when the average person looks at history, their question is, how does war start? As if it's the intruder, the unnatural thing. When the serious student of history begins to ask, how does it ever stop? Bloodshed and slavery and exploitation and imposing power on others is the constant norm in history. It is the defense of civilization that brings brief moments when people aren't chopping each other up. Brief little moments of peace and prosperity. And those moments are always cultivated by the right words. The gates shaken by the barbarians outside are only ever held back, always held back, only by a single pattern of sound words. It became fashionable a generation ago for evangelicals to begin confessing that all truth is God's truth. I've got an apologetics 101 book. All truth is God's truth. Yeah. Watch the Truth Project. But here's the problem. The anti-theologies of the anti-intellectual churches restricted this sentence to the parachurch, to a nebulous idea of culture war, a little intellectual hobby. In other words, to the isolation of a handful of folks like us who are obsessed with truth. But it's not to be taken seriously. Nevertheless, it is actually true that all truth is God's truth. And that means literally that all things are theological things, only understood through the lens of the right theology, not merely theology. There's no mere theology. God isn't treated like a mere equal thing with other things you don't care about. There's only the right theology and idolatry. All things are theological things, objects informed entirely by the being and the essence of God who made those things to say something about himself, Psalm 19:1. Objects that can only be properly understood as a pattern of theological information. As the 19th century theologian W.G.T. Shedd remarked, theology is a science concerned with both the infinite and the finite, with both God and the universe, end quote. Theology will put an explanation point on that very good question that philosophy already asked. How do we understand the nature of the human mind over against the rest of nature, the inhuman, the non-human? The order of our system of learning affects the kind of person that we will be. And there's only two basic choices. God-centered theology, defining all academic subjects at every point and every page, or a flattened, splintered, isolated, and meaningless subject matter. Our souls will be like the things we look at. Fracture the world and you fracture the soul. Treat things in a dark corner and you will be driven into a dark corner by Nazis that care more about this than you do. And Paul makes that crystal clear in Romans 1. If your soul does not learn objects of truth existing in a hierarchy, some things bigger than other things, more important than other things, with the immaterial things as objectively larger, more real than the material things, then they will be less like a rational soul and grow up to be more like an animal or more like a passive object of the state's manipulation. Shedd tells us why. In using the example of the distinction between geometry and geology, in his systematic theology, he says this, quote, now he's going to use two Latin phrases. And these Latin phrases, don't get turned off by them. A priori just means from prior. Before I look at a thing, I have an idea, and I'm going to apply it to that thing. A posteriori just means after, posterior to examination. So one's just deductive reasoning. That's that abstract we talked about. And then more scientific observation reasoning. Both good. It's not one's good, the other bad, but that's what he's talking about. So listen to Shedd's comment and see if you can get the, oh, that's why different subjects have to be arranged in exactly that order. Quote, an a priori science like geometry, so geometry, math, form, invisible, retracts no positions. It doesn't take anything back of its truth. Retracts no positions and is immutable, means unchanging, because its data are mental axioms and the logical conclusions from them. But Shedd says, an a posteriori science like geology, study of earth, is continually altering its positions because it derives its data from the notices of the senses. And the new notices show that old deductions were in errors. Accordingly, the laws of mind have more necessity in them than the laws of material nature have. Do you arrange those subjects in a theistic way or in an atheistic way? Where do you position geometry versus geology? Do you position geometry and geology atheistically, with them side by side as if the order didn't matter? Or do you position them other way around, geology up top, more real? Or do you position them theistically, with the necessary, invisible, immaterial truth going this way? Here's the principle. One of these things is unchanging logic. The other one, as you run down that spectrum down there, is changing data. I want unchangeable truth defining changing data. So on that chart I have from top to bottom, theology, and then the old breakdown between humanities and sciences. Up top I have formal thinking. Math, I thought that was practical. It is. There's a practical application just like there is in science. There's applied science and theoretical science, likewise in mathematics. But you don't start there or you're a slave and you're training your children to be slaves. You start up top and flow that way, theistically. Unchanging logic in those disciplines, beholding unchanging objects. That's your core. Changing data in those disciplines, beholding changing objects. Grasping that distinction is the key that unlocks the whole thing. If this is true, which is just another way of saying, if Christianity is true, then there's not only a hierarchy in our grammar, there's a grammar of hierarchies. We're communicating that order to our kids. When my kids were in kindergarten, I wanted them to start learning that biology, astronomy, chemistry, geology, and physics are the physical sciences. We're going to draw a circle around that. It studies nature. It's not that it's bad. I'm not stepping on it. I'm just saying it's that. That's that right there. It changes. It moves. What's called the social sciences today, economics, geography, political science, sociology, psychology, those things are about an invisible object. Say, what are you talking about? That's data. I can count what you do in supply and demand. What who does? Mere units or persons with souls? So how you arrange one over the other, kids don't have to know that when they're 5 to 9, but communicate the grammar that way so then when we get to be 10 and 11, they can start, they already have the circle. They already have the circle with those 5 words in that circle and those 5 words in that circle. That communicates a logic and a worldview to them. One worldview says, and it says it at every point of our grammar, one worldview says that invisible things are more real than visible things. In fact, that even our knowledge of the visible is actually a part of the invisible realm, because everything visible is an effect of its ultimate invisible cause, God. That's theism. Other educational systems, i.e. any educational system that is not Calvinistic in its orientation of the doctrine of God, just code word for the Christian worldview as it really is. Every other educational system, even ones that attempt the trivium, actually communicate vastly different worldviews. The co-inventors of the calculus, Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz, Newton said this. This is as late as the 17th century. He said that the task of the scientist is to think God's thoughts after him. And he meant that literally, because it was all an extension of geometry to Newton. Leibniz said about the laws of physics that, quote, they do not spring from a principle of necessity. In other words, physical things don't have a necessity in themselves. He said, but from a principle of perfection and order, they are an effect of the will and the wisdom of God. Now, you might already be convinced of all that. You might already be convinced that all legitimate subjects in school are theological objects. But then you might wonder why we should divide the knowledge of God into biblical and systematic theology, which is one of the things we do. It's obvious enough to Christians today how biblical theology provides a check on our systems of doctrine. But it might be less obvious how systematic theology safeguards our biblical knowledge of God from our own perversions. But allow Shedd again to explain this. He says, quote, systematic theology should balance and correct biblical theology rather than vice versa for the following reasons. First, because biblical theology is a deduction from only a part of Scripture. Its method is fractional. So think of scissors cutting out the parts that you like, making them mean what you want them to mean in isolation. Shedd says that a second reason why biblical theology requires a balance and symmetry of systematic theology is the fact that it is more easy to inject subjective individual opinions into a part of the Bible than into the whole of it. So we want to study the Bible as a whole. And it's not one versus the other, but we want to have a whole knowledge of the Bible. We need both. As Paul said to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:6, we are being trained in the words of the faith, that's the individual words, and the sound doctrine, he says. Both. But as thinking, remembering beings, those words mean things. And they still have to mean the same thing when we close our Bible at night and open it up the next day. So to review, everything on grammar and logic. General facts. Big facts. Unifying facts that draw circles around words. Circles around things. These facts are as much facts about particular things as singular word facts. They're actually more so. And consequently, logic is nothing but grammar in eternity. Logic, that whole stage and that whole science, is the mind drawing unchanging circles from heaven around changeable things on earth. You're actually colonizing. You're doing what Adam was doing in the garden, naming things. Consider what is meant by general facts being facts of grammar. Such unifying facts form the categories of logic. Which arrangement communicates a particular grammar? It communicates its own worldview. And its opposite communicates an opposite worldview. Last point, and this is really the application, the rhetoric stage. I'm not going to say as much about it for one reason, just because a lot of us don't have kids at that stage yet. But it's going to be the same idea. Objective defense or rhetoric. Simply read Paul's letters to Timothy and Titus, and you will be struck that there is this singular, unified thing that he has them defending and enlisting others to help indoctrinate with and so forth. He never leaves that behind. He's always saying to them when he's commanding things of them, do this with that, defend that, get other guys that can help you teach that. The that was that tupos in 2 Timothy 1:13. The pattern, the abstract, the one thing, the one way to see everything made up of words particular. Defend that. In 1 Timothy, Paul positions all moral evils against this singular thing called sound doctrine, chapter 1, verse 10. To defend it is to wage the good warfare in verse 18. If Timothy were to ask Paul, is there a Christian rhetoric? He might point him to where he said, and notice when I read this in 1 Timothy 6, 3-5, notice the assumption about sound words and singular doctrine. Same distinction we've been making. He says, if anyone teaches a different doctrine, the different singular thing, and does not agree with the sound words, the particular words, of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the teaching that accords with God, then as he is puffed up and conceited and understands nothing. I don't want somebody teaching my kids that understands nothing. Well, he's exaggerating. He's just, no, he's not. He understands nothing. He can, by instinct, repeat facts, no doubt, but he understands nothing. He says he has an unhealthy craving for controversy and for quarrels about words. Words, quarreling about words, defending words, that's bad. No, you said that. He didn't say that. He's describing this person's psyche. Quarrels about words which produce envy, dissension, slander, evil suspicions, constant friction among people who are depraved in mind and deprived of the truth, imagining that godliness is a means to gain. Notice that contrast between this unhealthy quarreling over words and the defense of sound words. Clearly, they can't be the same thing. Otherwise, Paul would be contradicting himself. He's saying defend sound words. And so a Christian rhetoric is an objective rhetoric, just like the other two. It's objective. It's not defending any old Christian words in any old order, but sound words that together make up that single type, a single system of doctrine. And we don't want to teach our kids that nearly everyone who taught us these things, that words are untrustworthy, that the defense of truth is the same thing as this evil quarreling. We don't want to teach our kids that. Rhetoric is for persuading the disobedient to be reconciled to God. Again, this is that stage from age 15 to age 18-ish. Now, the reason for doing this persuasion is, first of all, for the gospel, but also for the overall communication of the only rational worldview in which the gospel makes sense. Everybody wins with an objective Christian rhetoric. The unbeliever gets to hear the gospel. The believer gets to hear the gospel, disciplined by the Christian worldview, and those in the world who will benefit from these sound words. But that type is all important. As one more statement about this, Paul says in 2 Timothy 3:7, he speaks to those who are always learning but never able to arrive at a knowledge of the truth. Listen to that distinction. They're always learning something, presumably, but never able to arrive at a knowledge of the truth. I wonder what they're learning, if it doesn't amount to what Paul called the knowledge of the truth. Clearly, there must be bits and pieces of knowledge that can be taken in, but that don't add up, so to speak. They just hang there, like trivia, occasions to boast, material for deceiving others. But it's not that singular thing. Now, don't think of this rhetoric stage, last point about this. Don't think of this as some kind of four-year debating society. That's not what we're talking about here. That misses the point. It's vocational training. But here, I don't mean this the way the world does. That's one more casualty of war in this loss of meaning. Vocation, like every other word, is objective. It comes from the Latin word for call, vocare. And your vocation is not your answer to the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? It's not even, what things are you really, really, really good at? Now, that's important. Your desire, your ability is going to be important to vocation. That's why God gave you those. But that's not the heart of it. The question is this. What has God himself called you to do? What has he called you to be? I'm sure we all want to be doing any number of things that we're not doing right now. And I'm also sure that everybody here is talented at any number of things. But that doesn't mean that you're called to do those things. And likewise, our children are called by God. They are not at the end of the day. Now, that lady, every lie is a twisted truth. Our children really are not our property. They're not hers either. They're God's property. God has lent them to us in covenant for a little while. And he has called them. And our job is to help each one of them hear his voice, calling them into the great spiritual historical war that is fought through worldview. When the child's mind moves from grasping his or her worldview as a system of the world, then in those later years, we can see their exact place in it more clearly. And this begins to reveal itself in how they articulate it, how they defend it. That's what rhetoric's for. It's not to win arguments in isolation. It's not to impress people in isolation. But it is to be compelling with objective words in a singular objective worldview. As they look out, as they see the disorder in our culture, seeing things in bits and pieces, as our culture does, if their souls are already stamped with that one eternal order, then they will be more likely to move more quickly and sense the sphere in which they're called to bring order. Last point of application, and then we'll break and we'll ask questions. My talk and Josh's talk are really just two different parts in keeping everybody from flying off to two different extremes, or one of two extremes. And really, you can do both, believe it or not. But I'll show you what I mean by this. One extreme you could fly off to, I've already mentioned, it's called officialism. And the other extreme we'll call isolationism. But here's the key. Both extremes come from the same root, the same intellectual void. Both officialism and isolationism are the result of our failure to see truths in particular and truths in general as objects of the mind, more real than the animal scratchings and practical payoffs of the material world. Officialism does this one way, isolationism does it the other way. And these are the two temptations of the homeschooler and Christian school that's getting started. Here's what they do. Officialism turns back from objective truth and toward an official expert class to tell it what to think and what to do. It needs bells and whistles, like a slave needs the sound of the whip cracking. It needs some other structure, always some other structure more impressive than the one we're starting out with. To form thought like Pavlov's dogs need the bell to tell them when it's time to eat. We become creatures of structure stimuli and away from objective truth. Isolationism also turns its back on truth. It's horrified at that expert class that you saw represented by that woman. It's horrified by the expert class, and it turns away from a singular objective truth, because when it sees somebody saying singular objective truth, hard to think about, let's do that, it confuses that expertise with the expert class. If expertise, therefore expert class, we reason. And maybe we've heard too many Bodhi Bakum talks. By the way, I love Bodhi Bakum. But I know the way he's going to be taken. Deep in the red states. Reinvent the wheel. It's your responsibility. Not that reinventing the wheel is not my responsibility. Educating my children is my responsibility. But what do you mean by that? The Bible tells me, myself, and I to educate my child. Well, that's your way of putting it. I don't see that in the original Hebrew. What object will you use to educate? You might say, well, I'm going to use this thing over here. But don't you know that this thing communicates naturalism? It communicates Marxism? You got that from John Dewey? Well, it's my responsibility. I didn't ask you if it's your responsibility. I agree with you about that. I'm asking you what you're doing. See, in the isolationist mindset, the Bible's mandate to parents becomes a quest to reinvent every wheel, to prove our authenticity, our toughness, so that the opposite to officialism's shiny wheel with bells and whistles is a knee-jerk reaction to anyone with another spoke to lend or any axis for the whole thing to start turning with. Up from these two simple-minded extremes, the actual Bible calls all of us to do two things. The Bible commands all of us to educate our own children, Deuteronomy 6. And that same Bible tells the church to teach all disciples everything, Matthew 28:20. It teaches both. The parents alone are in a unique position to reach that soul and consequently have a unique responsibility to manage that system before God. And the church is uniquely qualified to teach the whole biblical worldview, which is what? Everything. So that the family and the church who are not doing this together are failing in that holistic mandate. Officialism and isolationism. Neither one is going to keep that lady's friend and all of their bayonets away from your kids. I'm going to pray, and then we're going to stay together and ask some questions. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for every single person that could be here. Bless our minds now. Bless our attention spans. Bless our affections as we feel and do and get ready to think and feel and do exactly what we ought to about this, Lord. Have grace upon us, Lord, and remind us that grace is infinitely extended, Lord. This is exciting. Thank you that you have revealed your law to us in grace, that we can do this with excitement and not compare each other as we compare notes, but that we can free each other up to do each spoke on that wheel and its axis better as we think your thoughts after you. Bless this time now. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.